Hi, this podcast is going to be from Miss Strachan and
Miss O'Neill.
And we're going to talk about To Autumn and
The Prelude.
And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the quotations, the meaning on both poems, and then how you could link them. And we're also going to discuss a little bit of the context. So we hope that will be useful, because we know that the nature poems haven't been everybody's favourite, but we think that these are two very good poems. So we'll start with To Autumn.
Okay, so I think with To Autumn, having a bit of understanding of the context makes the poem make a lot more sense overall. So Keats had seen a lot of death throughout his life. His brothers and his father and a lot of his family members had died from tuberculosis. Now, you don't have to worry about knowing how to spell that, because if you put TB, the examiners will know what you mean. And so autumn as a season in poetry usually symbolises ageing and death and decay. And so when you realise that he's seen a lot of death and then found out that he himself was going to die from tuberculosis as well, the title of the poem makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think what he does so nicely is he talks about all of, most of the seasons actually. So the close of the first stanza is, "For summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells." And that just means that the imagery there is quite interesting, because it means that summer, we need summer in order for the crops to ripen and to be ready to be pecked. And he's saying o'erbrimmed their clammy cells, meaning that they've, you know, they've given us plenty of stores for the autumn. So we obviously harvest in the autumn. So summer, the sun and the summer provides us with the ability to get the stores and bring in the crops during the autumn time, ready for winter.
And in that stanza, that there's also a quote, "Flowers for the bees," and the bees obviously pollinate the world and spread seed so that crops and plants and flowers can grow. And so that's quite a romantic line, because the romantics were in awe of nature and how it provides for us. So each season, although we have to store things and get our crops ready for winter, it is nature, it is summer and spring that provide food for us.
Yeah, and that's kind of repeated throughout the first stanza as well, with "fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel." So the repetition of the idea that nature is giving the crops and the plants and the food goodness is repeated throughout the first stanza. So it's quite positive, really. Summer is seen as a positive season. Summer and spring are seen as seasons which will help provide for food for humans and for us. And obviously it was very different then, because people did have to tend the land in order to be able to provide for their families. And if they didn't do that, they didn't have supermarkets across the world sending stuff over on ships to us. So it was very different in that respect.
And the verbs swell, plump, overbrimmed, they really emphasise that.
Yeah, so that brings us on to the second stanza. And we get a sense of the people within the second stanza, the people who are actually responsible for bringing in the crops and for making sure that everything, that they are getting ready for the winter. Because obviously when the winter comes, it's a hard time of year. And we say, "Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store?" And that's a rhetorical question, and it's asking the reader to consider what the people bringing in the crops are doing. So they're often within the store, they're often making sure everything is okay. And then when they're done, that's when they can rest a little bit. Would you agree?
I would. And structurally, the end of the stanza supports what you've just said, because towards the end of the stanza, it talks about a patient look and the last oozings hours by hours. So it's a much more calm and relaxed atmosphere, and the word oozings, because it drags out, it kind of symbolises that calm after the frantic kind of gathering and storing up of food.
Yeah, and within that, within the middle of that stanza, we also had "or on a half-reaped furrow sound asleep." And we all know that a furrow is the lines within a field. So someone has been gathering their crops, and then, you know, they're then sort of taking a rest because they're ready to be able to, you know, have a bit of a rest, have a bit of sleep. Most of the hard work has now been done. And we've got drowsed with the fumes of the fume of poppies, which is almost opiate like. So it's drowsed and the fume of poppies. It gives that softer, gentler feel to autumn. So suggesting that time is slowing down, which also links to the way that Keats is talking about perhaps the closeness between the seasons and the way that people, I can't think of the word, and the different stages of people's life, that's what I meant. So we've got the beginning of life as the spring, we've got the summer as the kind of the growing up and the maturing, then we've got autumn as coming to the end of your life, and then the winter representing the death. And I think that that's perhaps some of the, contextually, some of the way, the metaphor within To Autumn.
Yeah, definitely. And that would get you structure marks as well as context marks, if you could make that link. So the last stanza is my favourite, personally. It's quite energetic. And we've got the seasons coming back to life. So we've got this metaphor, the songs of spring, where all the animals are coming alive and they are bleating and singing and whistling and gathering. And it's like the animals are part of a choir celebrating this new season of life.
Yeah, and it's nice, isn't it? That lexical set relating to animals is really lovely. And it repeats, it repeats the idea that we should be thankful for nature. So we are thankful in the first stanza for the bees and for the sun ripening the crops, but equally we're thankful in the final stanza for the way that the birds and the lambs and nature within animals can be appreciated.
Yeah, so I suppose you could read it as Keats pondering life and death, and towards the end he almost comes to terms with that and realises that life is a cycle, and that although there's death, there will be life again, like the lambs in the final stanza.
Yeah, full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn. It's quite a nice image, isn't it? Because you can imagine the new life growing, because they're now fully grown, so they're not just small baby lambs, they are fully grown.
And in contrast, the wailful choir of the small gnats mourn. You've got that image of how tiny and insignificant certain things in life can be in the grand scheme of things, and that was a major focus of romantic poets as well, how we as people are mortal. And in the grand scheme of the universe, we are tiny and small. And you could talk about how the gnats kind of symbolise that belief that the romantic poets had. And maybe that's what Keats felt like when he looked out his window and saw all the beauty of nature.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because the stanzas are actually quite even. I think they're 11 lines each. So he's not saying that any stage of life is any more important than any other stage of life. So by structuring the poem in an even stanza with three separate stanzas, he might be suggesting that, you know, every stage of life is important. You know, if you're comparing the seasons to life, then every stage of life is as important as each other. They just have their different challenges and different ideas. And I think that probably brings us nicely to the excerpt from the prelude. Because yeah. Wordsworth was another romantic poet. And remember, we don't mean romantic as in love. We mean romantic as in the time period, 1850 to 1940, I think it was.
Yeah.
And the idea that they were celebrating nature and that they were celebrating the beauty in life. And I think the prelude, for me, does that really beautifully.
Because he's remembering such a treasured memory when he felt so alive and free. And he's out in the open at sunset, which, although we talked about romantic poets in a not in a romantic lovey-dovey sense, the first line to me, it says, in the frosty season when the sun was set, to me a sunset is a romantic image. So it's almost like this gorgeous image of nature inspiring awe in him.
Yeah, and with... And also he says it's a time of rapture. You know, rapture is that absolute unparalleled joy, the idea that you're having so much fun that you don't want it to stop. And I like the way that there's a colon after rapture, because it separates the word rapture and it helps to emphasise just how much fun he was having. And then after the colon, we've got clear and loud, the village clock tolled six. So you're getting a sense of time. So you're understanding that the day is coming to a close. But Wordsworth, who is ice skating within this poem, because we get that when he says hissed along the polished ice. So you get that sense of movement and that feeling that he is whizzing around on the lakes in the Lake District where this poem is set. And you just get the idea that actually, although the time of day is 6 o'clock and he probably should be going inside mm-hmm. and settling down for the evening, as a young person, he is just having so much fun on the ice that he doesn't want to leave his friends.
And I think twilight blazed, that verb blazed, kind of sums that up as well, because blazed has connotations of like power and passion and energy.
Yeah.
As does the simile wheeled about proud and exulting like an untired horse. If you think of the connotations of a stallion, they're free and proud and strong and full of energy, which is what he's feeling, hissing along the ice, like that sibilance of the shh. You can almost hear and see them all gliding along.
Yeah, it's almost automatic peak, isn't it? Because you can actually imagine, you can see it, you can picture it in your mind. And then we've got this idea of imitative of the chase and woodland pleasures, the resounding horn, the pack loud bellowing, and the hunted hare. So through the darkness and the cold we flew. It's almost like they are actually personifying a hunt. So making it feel like them chasing around on the ice is almost very similar to a fox being hunted, but being free and managing to get away. There's no feeling of danger. There's just a feeling of anticipation, like this is very exciting. And the use of the commas within those images and woodland pleasures, comma, the resounding horn, comma, the pack loud bellowing, comma, reinforces this idea of speed and pace and the fast kind of... The fast way that they are hissing along on the ice. And I think that it becomes a little bit darker as the poem goes along.
Yeah, it comes back to that romantic poet theme of we are mortal, we are vulnerable in the grand scheme of how vast nature is, because obviously if he grew up in the Lake District, he was used to vast mountains and lakes and rivers and this, you know, being surrounded by this beauty that makes you realize, oh, we are actually quite small in the grand scheme of things, which I think the precipices ringing aloud and the icy crags and the alien trying to find that metaphor, alien sound. We are small and insignificant in comparison to the unknown.
Yeah, and if you can picture as well the way that the Lake District's the way that they look, you've got these huge hills sort of surrounding lakes. So he's on a small lake surrounded by these vast, vast mountains, which with the sound of him and his friends and whoever else is around echoing and being captured by the vast mountains around them. And when the precipices rang aloud, you know, he's saying that, you know, you can hear these sounds coming from somewhere else. They sound almost alien. They don't sound real. And that's that recognition, isn't it, that he is smaller.
Mm.
He is just a small part in the bigger theme of life, I think.
Especially because he is a child in this memory as well. That kind of emphasises it even more. And then it kind of ends with really strong imagery. It becomes quite beautiful again and calm, and to me it's almost celestial imagery because we've got these stars and sparkling and the orange sky again, that vivid image of stunning beauty from nature.
Yeah, and evening died away, so when the sun was set at the beginning, it's almost like this excerpt, this small piece of the poem, the prelude, has been chosen really carefully, because we've got the sun was set at the beginning and then we've got it coming round in a circle to the evening orange sky died away. Mm. So the orange sky of evening died away is the quote to end the poem, and it reinforces the opening of the poem as well. So this structurally, it's only one small section of a larger poem, but it's been chosen very carefully to reinforce this small snippet in time that has been experienced, because we know that it was 6 o'clock. We know that the evening sky died away. So we're coming into night, and it is just a very short snapshot of memory from Wordsworth, who, interestingly, his parents died when he was very young. So for him, this memory is clearly very vivid and very joyful. So it would perhaps be before his parents died, because there's no sense of melancholy, there's no sense of sadness from Wordsworth. There is just a sense that he was enjoying being free and being young. And I think once you've experienced death of a family member, that feeling of being young and that feeling of being free can sometimes leave you, because you have realised there is a darker side to life. And at this point in time, Wordsworth seems to be talking about a very happy memory, a very vivid, happy memory, where nature itself emphasises and helps to reinforce the pleasure that he was getting. And I think that's a nice way to link the two poems, actually.
Yeah.
You've got the fragility of life, you've got the different seasons within life and nature. You've also got the way that people are presented within the poems. And in both poems, Too Often and the excerpt, I think that we see a real sense of calm, a real sense of acceptance of who we are and what we do. Half-reaped furrow, sound asleep. Obviously, that is a very relaxed image. And then we've got the kind of proud and exulting like an untired horse. Now, that's a contrast, isn't it? Because we've got the relaxed image and then we've got the kind of excited, full of life image. And it's a real contrast in the way that the two poems have been presented. Would you agree, Miss?
Yeah. And I would say a similarity is kind of that cyclical structure that they both had. So To Autumn goes through all the seasons. And kind of, it does start with a happy line, a mellow fruitfulness, and then finishes on the gathering swallows twitter in the skies, whereas Prelude, as you said, starts with the sun setting and then ends with it dying away as well. So it's like, whereas Prelude's a quick snapshot, Too Autumn is definitely more of a gradual process. over time.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, isn't it? The idea that the prelude is a snapshot and To Autumn is focusing on different stages of life. I think that To Autumn could be considered an extended metaphor.
Yeah.
Whereas the prelude wouldn't. I would say that it was an autobiographical extract. So another way that you could compare the two poems would be the way that nature is vast and beautiful and fulfilling for both the poets. And you get that throughout To Autumn with, you know, the bees and the way that that Keats describes the hedge cricket singing and the noise of spring. And you can get that with the leafless trees and every icy crag tinkled like iron. So you've got this real sense that nature is kind of an amazing place to be and an amazing thing for us to appreciate and to use, but to use wisely.
Yeah.
And I think we need to leave it there because the romantics would like you to just think about that for a while. Thanks very much. We hope this has been useful.
Bye.